lecture, which is on unconventional Fed operations. So basically the sorts of things the Fed has been up to since this recent crisis began. There's no way I'm going to be able to cover everything in just this 1 hour and 15 minute lecture. So I'm going to hit the major items. And I thought rather than just jump right in and start detailing all the various things that the Fed has been doing, I probably should spend a few minutes talking about what the problems were. Because if you don't understand what the problems were, then I think there's a risk of it's just going to be a bunch of repetition and think like monotonous detailing of statistics in various programs when you don't even know what the alleged problem was. And incidentally, this picture is supposed to be fire and brimstone. I don't know if that's coming across. Okay, so first of all, you probably heard people throwing around the terms mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations. So these are the things that everyone was calling toxic assets. You don't hear that phrase much anymore, but back in 2007 and 2008, that was a real big deal. So what are these things? Okay, first of all, let me relate those two terms to each other. The way most people use the terms, mortgage-backed securities are a subset of collateralized debt obligations. Okay, so what does it mean for collateral? That means, like, if you're lending somebody money and they pledge collateral, that means they have some real asset or some other asset backing it up. All right, and so the way a lot of people use it, as a mortgage-backed security is a type of a CDO. And so the way I remember it happening is in the beginning of the crisis, everyone was talking about mortgage-backed securities, and then as the crisis continued, people started talking about collateralized debt obligations more and more. Excuse me. All right, but for our purposes, just what's the basic intuition here? What's a mortgage-backed security? Here's the process. So commercial bank gives a mortgage, right? So some couple wants to buy a new house. They go to their local bank. They apply for a mortgage. The bank gives it to them. So right there, what happens is the couple now, you know, has signed legally binding contracts saying they promise to make monthly mortgage payments to the holder of the mortgage, which in the beginning is the commercial bank that granted it to them. And then the commercial bank gives the couple, whatever, $200,000, and they go and buy a new house. Now, that bank sells the mortgage to an investment bank on Wall Street, right? So the firm on Wall Street gives, whatever, $205,000 to the commercial bank, and then the commercial bank hands over the mortgage. And probably the commercial bank is still going to service the mortgage payment. So the couple that bought the house, they still send their monthly rent check or mortgage check payment to the local bank that gave them the mortgage, right? The community bank that they've been going to for 20 years. But that community bank no longer on its balance sheet is holding the mortgage on the asset side. They already sold that off to some firm in Wall Street. So that the community bank, you know, takes in the mortgage check every month and then sends it off to Wall Street, and they, you know, take a small cut for the provision of that service of collecting the payments. All right, so now what does Wall Street do? It goes around the country buying up thousands, perhaps, of these of mortgages from various local banks all around the country. And then it takes them all and it puts them into a big pool, right? So it's one giant pot. And so now every month, you've got thousands of couples around the country who just bought houses who are sending in their monthly mortgage payments, and they're all getting steered into one giant pot of money that the Wall Street firm is in charge of. And now, you know, why is the Wall Street firm doing it? Well, because they're going to sell something. What are they going to sell? They are going to sell various claims on that pot of money. And so those, you know, so that's the mortgage-backed security, is they're selling a security to somebody that is backed up by mortgages, hence the name. And what they do in particular is people can buy different what's called tranches of that mortgage-backed security. So I'm dumbing it down here, but the idea is, what happens if some people default on their mortgage payments, right? Some couples who bought a house, just the guy loses his job, or the woman, whatever, don't be sexist, and they can't make the mortgage payments, so they stop sending their checks to the local bank. So now the bank, of course, has no check to forward to Wall Street. So of that giant pool of money, they thought a certain amount was going to come in every month. Now less is coming in because some of the homeowners are defaulting on their mortgage payments. So now what happens with the shortfall? Well, this is where the tranches come in. So some investors who bought into the Wall Street, you know, sold pieces of these this product to, some investors are slated to take the first hit. So they have the riskiest tranches. And the idea is, if I'm making this up, but like the first 5% of the shortfall of the expected payments is allocated to this group of investors over here. Right? So if just even 5% of the people default, then those people are going to get nothing. Right? Every month they thought they were going to get their share of the incoming payments, and instead it goes from being a full payment to nothing. All right? And then maybe the next 5% is allocated to a different tranche of investors, and so on and so on. And so the safest tranche is like the one at the bottom of the pool of money, if you will. So it's like 95% of the homeowners would have to default before that safest tranche started taking a hit, because the way the MBS is structured, the other investors would have taken a hit first. Right? So how do they compensate for the different riskiness? Well, the yields are different. Right? So when the Wall Street firm is structuring the MBS and then selling off claims on it to various investors, the people who are willing to buy the top 5% tranche, you know, the one that's going to take the hit first, well, they have to pay less for the right to have dibs on that money, assuming enough money comes in to fill the pool up to at least the 95% line, if you get what I'm saying. Okay, so they have to pay a lot less for that. So what that means, if there aren't significant homeowner defaults and the money fills the pool up above the 95% line so that there's something there to start sending out to the holders of those really risky tranches, then their rate of return is huge, because they didn't have to pay that much to the Wall Street firm up front to get that very risky mortgage-backed security. Whereas on the other hand, the people at the very bottom, at the very safest tranches, they had to pay a lot to get, you know, their legal claims on the portion of the money that's going to accrue, so long as, you know, at least 10% of the homeowners don't default, that kind of thing. All right, so I'm, like I said, I'm dumbing it down, but I just want you to get the idea of how this all worked and why it was, and what was going along to make this process work. You can see from various people's point of view what was going on. So the big problem, the big picture is, a lot of people got mortgages that shouldn't have. All right, so a lot of people were buying homes that ended up sinking in value. And so not only were, so a lot more people were defaulting on their mortgage payments than anyone predict, well, than most people predicted, let's say in the year 2005. A lot of more people ended up defaulting on these things, partly because the economy crashed so heavily, so just a lot of people lost their jobs, but also people were engaging in strategic defaults, right? So if you bought a house for $300,000 and then 1 year later the value of it crashed to $200,000, you might just run the numbers and say, you know what, I'm not going to sit here and keep paying my mortgage on a house that just lost a third of its value in a year. I'm just going to walk away. And yeah, that'll hurt my credit, but in the grand scheme, I'd rather take a hit to my credit rating than to keep paying this ridiculous mortgage on a house that I thought was going to appreciate and just lost $100,000 in its value. Okay, so that's that kind of person would default. All right. So now, to understand how did the banks? So again, the big picture is, a lot of these huge financial institutions were sitting on these mortgage-backed securities, and all of a sudden the incoming flow of monthly mortgage payments dried up a lot more severely than they thought was going to happen, right? They were stunned at how, you know, the rate of defaults on these things. And so you got to say, well, you know, what went wrong? Well, there's a couple things. For one thing, the models that were used to assess the risks of these mortgage-backed securities, well, they were wrong. And these mortgage-backed securities, I should mention, I mean, I'm dumbing it down and making it sound like it's real easy. They were incredibly complex, some of these things, so that even the firms handling them, they didn't really know how to price them properly, right? So they had to just defer to these guys that were called quants, people literally like with physics PhDs that would get hired by shops on Wall Street who would then run very sophisticated mathematical finance models to try to price these things, right? Because it was an exotic product and people weren't really sure how to price it. So what was going on, and let me just try to give you again the big picture as to why was this sweeping the world. The real estate market in the U.S. and other countries was booming. And so the question is, if you're, let's say you're a mutual fund based in Europe, and you want to get exposure to the U.S. residential real estate market, but how do you do that? You know, you can't, you're not legally allowed if you're a mutual fund. You can't just go over there and send some of your people over to go buy houses in Las Vegas or something. And that'd be incredibly risky. You can't do that. But what you can do, maybe, depending on your, you know, your rules and so forth, is you can buy securities that are ultimately tied to the real estate market, but that Moody's or Standard & Poor's will give a AAA rating to. All right, and so what was going on here is all these, you know, this game, if you will, of taking all the mortgages from around the country and putting them all into one pool, and then creating derivative assets on that and slicing and dicing the cash flows and then selling them off to different investors. The point of that was to spread the risk around in different ways to allocate it to different investors based on their risk appetite. And so, like I say, if you are a certain type of fund that you just couldn't be allowed to go and start buying individual homes in the U.S. real estate market, but yet you wanted to get a piece of the action because, wow, man, the real estate's really booming in the U.S., this was a safer way you could do it. And specifically, how was it that these models that were run by S&P and Moody's and so on, how could they possibly have said that these things were AAA when it turned out, when the crisis hit, that, well, no, they're not? Lots of different things, and people, you know, talk about corruption and the fact that the firms maybe who stood to benefit from these things getting rated AAA were the ones that paid the ratings agencies. Like, just that's the way that their payment method works. And so you could say, well, they had a bias and that kind of thing. And that's probably all true. But one big thing was, in terms of the intellectual mistake, the computer models they were using to rate these things, they had to figure out, you know, what's the probability of the real estate market going down by 10%. Because, you know, they knew that could, if that were to happen, well, then they'd be in trouble for two reasons. One, people would strategically default. And two, you lose your protection. If you hold the mortgage, legally you have the ability, if the homeowner defaults, to take over the property. And so that's, you know, a protection for you. That, yeah, you'd prefer just to get the monthly payments in cash, but worst case scenario, if the person defaults, you can just take the property. So that stopgap measure, of course, is worth less to you if the property just fell 20%. So that's why a big fall in the real estate market was such a huge hit to all these people who were holding mortgage-backed securities. Okay, so anyway, back to the intellectual mistake. One of the big problems was these models thought that a mortgage-backed security referencing, you know, that was composed of mortgages drawn from all over the country, they thought that was very safe. Let me just back up to make sure you guys didn't lose me. Yeah, I don't know why it looks green. I'm not turning the Incredible Hulk. So these models, you know, they had probability distributions. So they would say, you know, what they'd have a probability distribution on the real estate market in Las Vegas, and they'd have one for the real estate market in Sacramento, California, and one for Miami, and one for Chicago, and so on. And so if a particular mortgage-backed security is built up of thousands of mortgages that are drawn from all over the country, then, and this is the crucial assumption, and you thought the outcome of the, you know, the random variable, that's the way they model these things, of the change in the real estate market in Nevada was independent from the change in the real estate market in Chicago, because historically, you know, different markets could be volatile, but if, you know, maybe the Nevada market goes up one year, but the Chicago market goes down, you know, that kind of, so that's the way that's what they were using to calibrate their estimates of likely movements in these real estate markets. And so the critical assumption, like I said, is they assumed that these were independent random variables. So if you know anything about probability theory, if you take a bunch of independent things and dump them all into the same pool, well, then the chance of getting a really extreme event is diluted, right? Because you would need, so an event that would occur, like if it, I'm making these numbers up, but let's say they thought the chance of the Miami real estate market going down 10% was, you know, one in five, okay? But then you'd say, okay, what are the chances of that happening in 10 cities at the same time? Well, then they would say it was a 1 in 5, you know, raised to the 10th power, because you would need that one outcome 10 times in a row. And if they're independent events, then you just keep multiplying it by that probability. So the chance of the whole thing going down 10%, you can see, is really small. So that was the mistake they made. So a different way of putting it is the event that actually did happen, where there was a simultaneous plunge in all major real estate markets from, you know, 2006 to 2008, let's say. I mean, that was an event that, according to their model, should have happened once every 50,000 years or something. I'm making those numbers up, but it was of that magnitude, that what they thought was conceivable. All right, so that just shows the hubris that went into these models. And if you're familiar with names like Nassim Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan, I mean, that's why guys like that were all of a sudden such big deals when this happened, is because people like him were warning that, you know, these models that these people on Wall Street are using, they're giving us a false sense of security, that they're modeling the world in a certain way, and they, you know, out pops these conclusions that, yeah, this thing is safe and the chance of this thing blowing up is 1 in 2 billion, but the assumptions going into the model are wrong. And so that's what they were warning people about. Okay, another little thing is mark-to-market accounting. So here the problem was that all these hedge funds and whatever, investment banks, they're holding billions of dollars worth of mortgage-backed securities, and now the value of these things all of a sudden is uncertain, right? Because people start defaulting on their mortgages. This is an unprecedented collapse in the real estate market, and so now people are saying, whoa, because now they're not sure how to value these mortgage-backed securities. So the market for them seizes up, particularly the ones that were composed of subprime mortgages, right? The mortgages that were made to people that didn't have adequate credit standards, right? So they were risky mortgages. And so now nobody wants to buy these things. And so all the firms are stuck with them, so that's one problem, and they have to write them down, but they're not sure how much to write them down. So that's one problem. But even beyond that is all the other hedge funds, whatever, that are holding these things, even if the cash flow is still coming in, even if people haven't defaulted yet, they've lost the market price for these things, because now no one's trading in them. And so the market for them isn't liquid anymore. And so according to accounting rule changes that had been put into place, you were supposed to mark your books to market, meaning you were supposed to go through periodically and plug in what the current market value was of all your assets. And the spirit behind it, the reason for that, was to keep people honest. You know, with all the Enron scandals and that kind of stuff, you didn't want management to be able to just plug in their own estimates of what their assets were worth. because then that leaves all sorts of room for, you know, hanky-panky. So the idea was, let's be objective, go through and look at the market price to say how much these things are worth on your balance sheet. But again, the problem was, what happens if you held hundreds of millions or even in some cases billions of dollars worth of these things, and now the market just dried up? What are you supposed to use? What price do you plug in for them? And it just caused a downward spiral, because so then firms would have to have fire sales, right? Some firms, using that rule, like their capital would be dangerously low, because they'd have to plug in the fact that, well, according to the last market traded price, we just lost whatever $200 million on our mortgage-backed securities, even though the cash flow is still coming in, maybe, and then that makes, you know, our capital go down. And so now we have to raise more cash. We got to do something. So what do we do? Well, we got to start selling off some of our assets and consolidate. And so maybe they have to sell off these things that they're holding. And it was just it was like a domino effect that various financial institutions had to start selling off assets, sometimes assets that they were perfectly happy with, that they thought, if we could just hold these things to maturity, it'll be fine. These people aren't going to default. But just because of the capital crunch that they were getting, you know, they had to raise funds, and so a lot of them were forced to sell these things. But that just exacerbated the problem, because then now, even if you're totally healthy, you know, so even a financial institution that wasn't holding subprime mortgages, let's say, some other financial institution was holding subprime and conventional mortgage-backed securities, and that institution got in trouble, right, because its subprime ones are blown up. So it starts selling off everything, including the regular mortgage-backed securities. And so that pushes down the price of those things because nobody wants them. And so now you're this original firm, and you were fine at the beginning of the crisis, but now because these other competitors are selling off stuff, some of which you hold, even though you think they're fine, now their market value goes down. Oh, no. And so now because of mark-to-market, you're in trouble. And so you have to start selling off stuff. All right. So that was the idea. Incidentally, I don't have time to go into it now. If you want to in the Q&A, we can come back to it. But I'm not saying mark-to-market accounting was bad. I'm saying the rules that the government had in place that forced firms to do certain things, I think in this case, turned out to be bad and sort of exacerbated the problem. But in general, I'm fine with the concept of mark-to-market. I just think what was bad is that there were regulatory requirements where firms had to do something because of how the number popped out. Whereas in the real world, you know, if it were just a free market and investors could look, I mean, a firm could report to its investors and say, yeah, technically this is what the market value of our assets is, but, you know, have a big asterisk and say, come on, look at these things. This is because the market dried up. You know, we think that this is going to be fine, and so don't sell our stock off because you're scared of this. You know, they could do something like that. Whereas with a rigid mechanical regulatory rule, you know, you couldn't say that. You just had to blindly say whatever the market price was. Okay, credit default swaps. I'm gonna try to move through this stuff quickly to spend more time with the stuff about what the Fed actually did. But again, it's important that we understand the big picture and all these buzz phrases. Okay, so a credit default swap, what that is, and this has to do with what happened to AIG. That's why I'm focusing on this. So it's just, think of it as an insurance contract that pays the buyer of the credit default swap in the event of what's called a credit event. All right, so for example, AIG, let's say there's a foreign investment bank, and it has bonds issued by Chrysler. All right, so that that company obviously is going to be worried if Chrysler goes into bankruptcy and possibly defaults on its bond payments. So what they can do, the foreign investment bank that's sitting on bonds issued by Chrysler, is they can go to AIG, which is an insurance company. AIG sells conventional life insurance and fire insurance and stuff like that to individuals, but it also had subsidiaries that dealt with financial products. And one of the things they would do, so they would sell a credit default swap. So this foreign investment bank could say to AIG, basically, I want to take out insurance on my Chrysler bonds. So AIG would look at Chrysler's books and blah, blah, blah. And then they would say, okay, you know, you pay us this certain amount, like the premium, and then we'll provide you with insurance, and it would be calibrated for the dollar amount of insurance you were buying. And so the idea would be, if Chrysler defaults on its bond payments, then AIG makes a payment to people who hold credit default swaps. All right, so the point of the foreign investment bank, of course, is to hedge its risk. And also, just more generally, you can buy credit default swaps even if you don't own the thing. So it's like, if you thought your neighbor's house was going to burn down, if you could buy fire insurance on your neighbor's house. And so if it did burn down, then the fire insurance company would send you a check, even though you didn't lose any property, right? So that's why some people think the credit default swaps are weird. But anyway, that's how it went. Okay. So what happened with AIG is it got into trouble. The conventional life insurance and fire insurance and all that kind of stuff was fine. You know, those divisions didn't lose any money. And also, even it's not even the case what you might think. You might think that AIG got in trouble because it had to start writing checks because of all these defaults, all these credit events that it had insured against. But even that's not really true. What happened was when the crisis was intensifying and everyone's freaking out and Bear Stearns fails and Fannie and Freddie get taken over and everything's going crazy, AIG's counterparties, right, so the people who had paid money to AIG to buy credit default swaps and who now are starting to think, uh-oh, a lot of these credit events might happen, and so AIG is going to legally owe us a bunch of money, but in fact, we know AIG has sold policies, you know, credit default swaps to lots of people, so we're not sure AIG is going to be able to pay us in case this credit event happens. So a lot of the counterparties, like Goldman Sachs and so on, were saying to AIG, we want you to post more collateral. We want you to, you know, show us that you freed up money, as it were, sitting in a pile there, that in case you have to pay us on these credit default swaps, we can be sure that you're going to be able to do that. Right. So in other words, they didn't want AIG to have a bunch of assets that were real illiquid. They wanted AIG to have a bunch of ready cash sitting there in case they had to pay Goldman Sachs and all these other people on the credit default swaps. And that's what killed AIG, that its counterparties, you know, insisted on so much collateral that AIG couldn't, you know, their assets were real illiquid and things. You know, they couldn't come up with it. And so that's why they went under. It wasn't that they had to write too many checks because of credit events. Okay. You might have heard a lot. The thing that really caused a crisis and that was the event or the pretext, if you're conspiratorial, that allowed Henry Paulson to push through the TARP program was that in September of 2008, there was a run on money market mutual funds. All right, so let me just walk through very quickly what's going on with that. So a money market mutual fund, what's a mutual fund? It's a vehicle for basically smaller investors. Well, it doesn't have to be smaller, but people who want to basically invest, give their money to some managers who then go out and invest in things on their behalf. All right, and specifically, you buy shares of the mutual fund. So now a money market mutual fund is a particular type that is supposed to be very, very safe. All right, so they take their investors' money, and then the investors technically buy, you know, they have shares in the money market mutual fund. And then the mutual fund goes out and buys real short-term but very safe assets. So they call it high-grade commercial paper, which is a corporate bond that's shorter than a year in duration, things like that. Or they might go buy 3-month treasuries, things like that, or certificates of deposit. Okay, so they invest in things that are real liquid and very safe. And the way it works is the share price is always supposed to be a dollar, what's often called a net asset value. And then if the fund does well, the way it it doesn't let its share price go above a dollar. It just distributes dividends to the investors. Okay, but again, the thing with money market mutual funds is you're not speculating. It's supposed to be like a place to put your money beside putting it in a savings account. Right? So they're supposed to be very safe. And so breaking the buck means if for some, you know, incredible reason the money market mutual fund suffered losses and its net asset value dropped below a dollar. That's what breaking the buck means. All right. So specifically what happened in September 2008 was Lehman Brothers failed, and that shocked a lot of people because the Fed had bailed out Bear Stearns earlier in the year. And so Lehman goes under, so that shocked a lot of people. And so then the Reserve Primary Fund, which was a major money market mutual fund that had been around for a long time, when they dealt with the fact that they were, you know, they had, I believe it was bonds issued by Lehman, that they thought, okay, we're not going to get paid off in full on this because Lehman just filed for bankruptcy. So they, you know, marked the losses down, and then it turned out their NAV was 97 cents. Okay, so they so Reserve Primary Fund broke the buck. That was, I believe, only the second money market mutual fund in history, you know, and they had been around for, I think, like 30 years, something like that, that this had been the case, right? I think the previous one, the first time, I think, was in 1994. Okay, so when we say that a money market mutual fund breaking the buck is rare, that's what we're, you know, it really was rare. This was the second time it had ever happened, the last time in 94. So that made people go nuts, particularly in the context of all the other stuff that was going on. So there was a run on money market mutual funds, in a sense, like a bank run. So lots of investors were taking their, you know, they were telling the money market mutual funds, we don't want our shares anymore, give us our money back, and we're going to go put it in a conventional bank that has FDIC insurance, right? Because up till this point, money market mutual funds were not FDIC insured. They were still very safe, but the point is, technically, they didn't have a government guarantee. So lots of people were doing that, and then that just exacerbated the problem, right? Because if people want to make withdrawals from their money market mutual fund, what does the fund have to do? It has to start selling off its assets to be able to, you know, raise the money to give back to the investors. And so then there's a couple problems there. One is, again, you had this fire sales. So precisely at a time when the credit markets are seizing up and various assets are plummeting in value, now you don't want to have a whole nother wave of institutions just engaging in mass sales. And then also, what the money market mutual funds did was they provided liquidity, right? So there were a lot of big corporations that would issue what's called commercial paper, which again is short-term, it's basically like short-term bonds. And so that was just the way they operated, that they would issue a bunch of commercial paper, the money market mutual funds would give them money for it, and then they could go buy inventory or, you know, pay their employees or whatever. And then, you know, the short-term commercial paper would come due, but they would just reissue it. Right, so it was like having a line of credit. So it would be like if you were a household and you had a charge card, and that you would go out and, you know, charge a few thousand dollars, you know, buy your groceries, buy your gas or whatever, and then at the end of the month the bill would come due, and you'd pay that. And then the next month, though, you'd go around charging stuff. So like at any given time, you would have, let's say, up to $2,000 worth of debt, but it would always be very one month debt. You'd always pay that off within by the close of the month. But the point is, if all of a sudden you got cut off and your charge card company said, we're closing your account, you know, you settle up with us, you have to pay what you owe us, but then we're not giving you any more credit, well, then you'd hit a brick wall, right? That you maybe would have been in a position where you were really counting on being able to always roll over that one month loan, as it were. And so then all of a sudden you'd have to settle up with them with cash, and then you would need to just use cash to buy your groceries and your gas and whatever is going into the next month. And maybe you didn't have it because you were like kind of a month behind, as it were. So that's the position that a lot of these big companies were in, that that, you know, they wouldn't be able to do their short-term financing. Okay, so anyway, this was the huge problem. And so the Treasury ended up insuring the net asset value of money market mutual funds up to a dollar. And they said that they limited it and said this is only true for investors who have put their money in before that announcement. Okay? So, moving along. All right, credit spreads. So here, this was another indication of why the world was ending, as it were, in the fall of 2008. So here, the idea is you want to look at the interest rates on various types of debt. So one thing you might look at is the spread on, so here I'm charting, the green line is BAA corporate bonds. The red line is AAA corporate bonds, and the blue line is the 7-year treasury. So you can see that from like 2005 to 2007, they move in tandem to mid-2007, and the blue, it goes the blue line, the red line, the green line. That makes sense. That you, if you're going to lend money to the U.S. government, you're going to insist on a lower interest rate than if you lend money to corporations that Moody's say that their bonds are rated AAA, which is, you know, really good, versus if you're going to lend money to corporations that Moody's set only gives a BAA rating to, because that's riskier than the AAA rating. So Moody's is saying that the AAA company is less likely to default on you than the BAA company. And of course, Uncle Sam is considered the safest borrower on earth. So that's why these things are line up the way they do, but you can see the gaps between them just got huge starting in mid-2007, but particularly by mid-2008. You can see how the gaps just went crazy, that the yield on treasuries plummeted while the yields on BAA zoomed up, and then the AAA actually didn't move around that much. That stayed roughly constant. Okay, so next slide, you can see I just took the difference there. So this is just charting the difference between the AAA bond and the 7-year treasuries. And the reason I picked the 7-year treasury, in case you're wondering, is I'm not certain of this, but I believe that those Moody's ratings are referring to 7-year corporate bonds. But I'm not positive of that, but that was the best I could come up with. So you can see that the spread on those things that goes from a high point in early 2003, and then it just drops all the way down to early 2007 and then zooms way back up. And so the idea here is, and you may have heard people talking about this, that during the housing bubble years, investors, they weren't worried about risk. They started taking a lot of risks. And what the way that manifested itself is that the yield they were willing to tolerate when they lent money to various corporations was not much more than what they would ask from Uncle Sam. All right, another common benchmark when it comes to credit spreads is what's called the TED spread, and that stands for Treasury and Euro Dollar. Okay, so it's, Rob Rivers is here, I'm not going to bother getting into that too much, but that's just another conventional thing. So it's looking at the 3-month yield on loaning money to Uncle Sam versus how much you'd have to pay in what's called the London Interbank Market. So it's like if you wanted to borrow money over in Europe and you were a major bank trying to raise money, what interest rate would you have to pay? And so that spread was something that people were using during the crisis. And you can see that spread went really low from 02 to 07, and then starts rising, and then it just goes through the roof when the crisis hits. So that was what a lot of people were looking at as showing just how bad the credit, just how tight the credit markets were. You might remember people were referring to a credit crunch. That was one indicator of it, is they were trying to show that, look at, if you're a corporation and you're trying to raise money, things have gotten a lot tighter now than they were for the last 6-7 years. Now, we don't have time to dwell on this too much, but what's funny here is everyone was pointing this like to show how awful things were, but really, if you looked at a bigger, and they would show charts like this one, like the one I'm showing you right here, because it makes it look like, oh, everything was normal, and then all of a sudden, holy cow, the, you know, the spread goes through the roof. But if you looked at a longer term picture, you would see that corporations, you know, the absolute amount they were having to pay to borrow money was still low historically. So what happened is that the rates they had to pay dropped to ridiculously low levels during the housing bubble years. And they got used to that. And then when things started moving back towards sanity, all of a sudden they were freaking out and saying, oh my gosh, we can't expect us to pay this much. You know, let me just back up a slide to show you what I mean. I mean, look at this. It's, if you're a AAA corporation, even at the height of the panic, you were paying a little over 6% on your bonds, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that's not outrageously high. It's just that they got used to paying 5% in the middle of the housing bubble, and so had to pay 6% seemed out, you know, outrageous. Okay, the last point I want to make on this general issue of the problems that we faced, the U.S. economy and other economies we're facing, is the difference between liquidity and capital. And that's a picture of Henry Paulson, who was President Bush's Secretary of the Treasury. So what was going on, and you may remember if you were following blogs and so on back in September of 2008, is that a lot of people were saying, well, no, I mean, the Fed has lowered interest rates. What's going on? How come things aren't working? And then people were saying that, no. See, the problem is the banks are suffering from capital constraints, not from liquidity constraints. So the Fed lowering interest rates, that's not going to do anything. The problem here is that these banks, their capital has been wiped out. And so that's why we need to recapitalize them. All right, so that is the difference. So that's what TARP was supposed to do. TARP being the Troubled Asset Relief Program, that originally the plan was Paulson was going to take $700 billion from the government and then go and buy the assets from the banks. And the problem there was that there was no really good solution. If they just paid what the market price was for these things, these so-called toxic assets, the things that the markets had totally dried up for, if the Treasury just paid the going market price, that wouldn't help the banks out. Right, because they already were valuing them on their books at the market price, and they were getting crushed. They were all insolvent. That was the problem. And so they're having to come up with all sorts of funny ways to keep themselves solvent on paper, because they didn't dare want to value them at their true market price. So if the Treasury just came along and said, hey, we'll buy those things from you at what we think the fair market price is right now, that wouldn't help the banks any. So the only way that you're going to help them is if the Treasury deliberately overpaid for those things. And so that would have been a problem, because it would have been a guarantee, you know, that would have been like just the taxpayers handing over money to these banks. So that was a problem. So what they ended up doing, as you know, is Paulson gets Congress to fund the TARP program under the assumption that he was going to use it to buy assets. I mean, that's the name of the program, Troubled Asset Relief Program. And instead, as soon as he got the money, he turned around and said, actually, on second thought, we're just going to buy ownership stakes in all of these institutions. All right, so that's what happened. So anyway, regardless of the history of it, I just wanted to make that distinction, that if you have, you know, they wanted, the ostensible purpose was to get banks to start lending again. And the problem was that these banks had all suffered huge losses on their assets. And since that was the problem, that meant their capital had taken a huge hit. And so the way you fix that is not to be willing to give them loans at low interest rates. That by itself isn't going to help them if the problem is that their capital is dangerously low. Instead, what you need is to have new investors come in and buy ownership in the company and pump in more capital. Right. So if you're not quite getting that distinction, just go back to the lecture I gave on fractional reserve mechanics. I forget what the name of the title was, but the one where I'm going through balance sheets, and there I talked about the difference between borrowing money and having an investor come in and pump in capital. One last thing, just to make sure you don't get confused, the TARP program was not run by the Federal Reserve. The TARP program was run by the U.S. Treasury. Okay, so now we're finally going to start going through the things that the Federal Reserve did. Okay, quantitative easing. That's the big fancy one. If you want to say, first of all, what does quantitative easing mean? Why are you calling it that as opposed to what? What's qualitative easing? What are you talking about? There's not a unanimous opinion, but I think most economists would agree that saying quantitative easing, what we're focusing on is the amount of money that's being injected, as opposed to looking at a change in the target interest rate. So if you think back, before this crisis, when the financial press would report on what the Federal Reserve was going to do, they never talked about how much in reserves was going to get pumped in, or or the dollar amount of assets that the Fed was going to buy. They didn't talk like that at all. They just said, the Fed today announced that it will lower its interest rate target by 50 basis points, or the Fed's going to raise interest rates. Right? They never talked about how the Fed did that, whereas with QE, now they're not talking about changing the interest rate target because they can't. The interest rates have already been pushed down to basically zero. So now if the Fed wants to do something, it can't just announce we're going to push the interest rates down. They have to say, well, interest rates are basically stuck at zero, but you know what? We're going to pump in $600 billion more dollars. So what do you think of that? So that's part of what's going on. Now, some economists will say, no, what's really going on with QE is they push short-term interest rates down to zero, and now they're saying, okay, that didn't work. So what do we do? Well, let's push down longer-term interest rates. And there's some truth to that because the Fed, in its quantitative easing announcements, it mentions that the treasuries it buys are longer-term treasuries, right? So the Fed is not going to buy $600 billion worth of three-month T-bills. Instead, it's going to buy longer-term, like five-year treasuries, presumably, to push down the five-year yield. Because remember, there's not just one interest rate. There's a yield curve. And so, and typically, and this is true right now, on shorter-term yields, right, so 3 months, 6 month, 1 year, the interest rate's lower than on longer-term yields. And so when we say right now interest rates are zero, well, first of all, no interest rate is zero right now, but even the ones we have in mind, we mean very short-term yields. But if you want to buy a 20-year bond from Uncle Sam, the yield is not zero. It's higher than that. Okay, so that's another aspect to this. Okay. Let's see. All right, QE1. That began in March of 2009. And I'm putting the approximate here. It was going to buy about $1.3 trillion in mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. And the reason I'm saying approximately is it depends which person you read as to what they actually announced. Because if you go and look at the actual announcement that the Fed made in March, the numbers are not $1.3 trillion. They're smaller than that. But what happens is the Fed had earlier announced $500 billion in purchases, and then they came along and up the ante. So most people, when they're talking about QE1, are just lumping it all together and saying it was a plan to buy roughly $1.3 trillion. Okay, so that's, and some people might even list different numbers because they would include other things as part of the whole thing. So anyway, I'm certainly not going to quiz you on the number. I'm just letting you know, in case you see different numbers, that I haven't been able to find one authoritative source. And again, if you go to the Fed's actual announcement in March of 2009, the number is lower than this. Okay, QE2, just to give you the history on that, it was in 2010, but it's going to get tricky when you want to figure out when did it happen, because it officially was announced right after the November elections, the 2010 elections. But various Federal Reserve officials had been hinting that it was going to happen as early as August of that prior summer. And so, as we'll see, either the proponents or the opponents of QE2 can point to and say, well, no, I mean, QE2 started to work in the summer because everyone knew it was coming. Or if you want to make fun of QE2, you can say, no, I'm going to have QE2 start right when they officially announced it. All right, so let me just show you a few things about these programs and the effects that they had. So I think one thing for sure we can say is, well, not for sure, but in my mind, what turned the stock market around? It was the first QE program. So here on this chart, the blue line is the monetary base, and the red line is the S&P 500. So you can see here that starting in late 2007, the stock market starts falling, then it dips up a little bit, and then it just starts crashing in the last half of 2008. And depending on your politics or whatever, you can say it's because they knew Obama was going to get elected, or you could say it was because of, you know, the credit crunch, and that was what it was, you know, who knows. But for whatever reason, the stock market absolutely crashes going through 2008, and then it turns around. So you can see it's going down the red line, and then right in March of 2009, the red line turns around in a dime and starts going back up. And you can see from the blue line that that's right when the monetary base sort of, you know, hung out for a minute, and then it starts zooming back up again. Okay, so again, just to repeat that, all this huge stuff the Fed started doing starts in September and October of 2008, and you can see the blue line zooming up, and that didn't totally stop the stock market fall. But then in March, the Fed announced and came back on the scene and said, we're going to pump in another total $1.3 trillion, and then you can see that's when the stock market starts zooming around again. Okay, one last thing on QE, and then we'll move on here, is QE2 and interest rates. So, or actually, we got one more thing, right? Yeah, okay. QE2 and interest rates. So here, it depends who you talk to. And that's the problem with this stuff. So people like Scott Sumner, if you know that name, he's what's called a quasi-monetarist, and he's real big on the fact that the Federal Reserve has not been creating enough money, and that's the reason we're in this problem. All right, so I think he's nuts. I've told him that. He's a nice guy. He's really smart, but I think he's crazy. Okay. He thinks that QE2 worked like a charm. Other people, it's not as obvious. They will say that the function of QE2 was to lower interest rates. And so the reason I'm exonerating, let me tell you the conventional thing, and then I'll tell you what Scott says. Okay, so if the point of QE2 is to lower interest rates and therefore stimulate people to go out and borrow and spend, well, it's a little bit problematic, because here you can see 5-year Treasury yields were dropping from, what is that, about, let's say, April of 2010. They're dropping steadily. And then when do they turn around is in early November 2010. Okay, so prima facie, if I wanted to make the argument that QE2 caused interest rates to start zooming upward, then I could make a pretty good case just by pointing to this chart, because right the beginning there, right after the election, so early 2000, early November, is when QE2 was officially announced. Now, proponents of QE2, they have two different responses. So I'm not going to take a stand. Plus, we're running out of time here, so I don't want to dwell on this too much. But what's going on is some people will say, no, QE2 did lower interest rates because people started hearing it, expecting it in the summer of 2010. And so, the yields were falling, but then the problem is you'd say, okay, well then why did they turn around after the election when QE2 was formally announced? And they could say a couple things. They could say, well, it's because the announcement wasn't for as much as they thought. And that's plausible, because when they were surveying various hedge fund managers and market watchers and things in August and September and October, asking them, how much do you think QE2 is going to be? People were saying numbers all over the place. Some people were saying they might inject another $1.5 trillion. All right. So again, one plausible explanation for this chart is to say people started expecting that the Fed was going to announce a humongous purchase in November, and that's what was pushing down interest rates. And then when the Fed came out in November and said, we're only buying $600 billion, the market was shocked and said, what, you're only buying $600 billion? We thought you were going to buy $1.5 trillion. And so that's why interest rates started zooming up. All right, so that's one thing. A problem with that is you can see interest rates were falling well before there were rumors of QE2. So, that's kind of hard. Another thing you could say is that the turnaround in interest rates has to do with the election. That it was, because remember, this election's when the shellacking occurred. And so you could say investors, for whatever reason, thought that the election of a bunch of Republicans to Congress was a reason that interest rates should have been higher. And there you can come up with all sorts of explanations for that. You can say because they thought the Republicans weren't going to allow the Bush tax cuts to expire, or they weren't going to raise taxes. That's an equivalent way of putting that. And so they thought the deficit was going to be bigger, and therefore interest rates had to be higher. Or you could say they thought the Republicans were going to stop Obama from doing all kinds of crazy stuff to hurt the economy, and that meant the economy would grow faster, and so you need to have higher interest rates because of stronger growth. Okay? So anyway, I'm just going through all these different things, and I don't even have time. I'm not even going to go into what Scott Sumner says, because it's difficult. Like, he looks at the stock market, and for him, everything's about expectations. But anyway, if nothing else, this episode should show you why it is that economists, like, this is not a laboratory science. We can look at the same chart and come up with 15 different explanations of what happened. We can't even agree if it was a good thing or a bad thing. Because again, to have the interest rate go up, you could say it's because people thought the Republicans were going to usher in better economic policies, and so the economy would grow more. Hence, investors need higher returns to put their money in bonds because they could just put it in the real economy. Or you could say it's because they thought the deficits were going to be higher, and so therefore they needed to charge more on loans to the government. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about interest on excess reserves. So here, this chart, you can see just what the problem is, that historically excess reserves were basically zero. I mean, they weren't zero, but they were a few billion dollars. And then once this crisis began, they just shot up over $1 trillion. So what is the extra interest on excess reserves? It is the fact that the Federal Reserve pays 0.25 basis points in interest to banks when they keep their excess reserves parked at the Fed. All right, so it's not on reserves, it's on excess reserves. So remember, in terms of a standard commercial bank, if they've got, they have a certain amount of reserves, and then you look at their deposits and you figure out legally where their required reserves. And if their actual reserves are higher than the required, that difference is the excess reserves. So if they wanted to, they could lend those out in the federal funds market, earning the federal funds rate, or they could make new loans to their own customers. And in the process of doing that, that would raise their required reserves, right? Because their customers would now have more checking account balances. And so the higher their required reserves are for a given amount of total reserves, that would shrink the excess. And so they would have less to earn interest on. All right, so let me just explain to you the initial rationale for this. So this started in October of 2008, I believe, is when it actually began with the Federal Reserve. I think they were talking about it the month before, but I think they actually got permission to do it in October of 2008. All right, so here, this chart should show you what the initial rationale was, and this chart will sort of back it up. So initially, back when they started doing this, what people were saying at the time, in particular the Federal Reserve officials, they were saying that the Fed needed this because of the odd situation we were in, that the Fed needed it to free its hands up so it could do two things at once. So in particular, what was going on is in September of 2008, the Fed had a certain target for the federal funds rate. And then, but at the same time, it wanted to start doing things like bail out AIG and then start, you know, rescuing other financial institutions by giving them loans or taking their assets and doing short-term swaps with them and things like that. So a lot of the stuff the Fed was going to do was going to increase the amount of reserves in the system. So other things equal, the Fed starts pumping more reserves into the system. Banks are then going to be in a position to lend in the federal funds market at a lower interest rate, so that's going to push down the actual federal funds interest rate. But what if the Fed doesn't want to do that, right? So in other words, the Fed's got two different things going on. On the one hand, it wants to have a certain target for the federal funds rate, and on the other hand, it wants to do things in terms of asset purchases or short-term loans that are going to increase the amount of reserves. And it wanted to be able to separate those two. Because remember, in normal conventional Fed operations, those two are intricately tied together. If the Fed wants to lower the federal funds rate, then it buys assets and pumps reserves into the system. And vice versa, if it wants to raise the federal funds rate, then it sells assets and sucks reserves out. But here, the Fed wanted to be two different things. It wanted to have a certain federal funds rate, and it wanted to be able to do things. So I guess another way of putting it is, the Fed wanted to be doing stuff with its assets. It wanted to expand its balance sheet, not because it wanted to push down the federal funds rate, but because it wanted to do stuff with those assets. That was the way the Fed was going to be helping the financial sector, was by directly intervening in particular asset markets. Okay, so that was the initial rationale they gave as to why they needed the ability to pay interest on reserves, excess reserves. So look at this chart. You can see, I cut it off in January 2008 just to blow it up, but I mean, it would have been similar going way back. That generally, so the red line here is the federal funds target rate. That's what if you looked at the Federal Reserve's meetings and they said this is what our target is for the interest rate, for the federal funds rate, that's what the red line is. So that's why it's not very squiggly, because it's just every meeting they say what the rate is and that's what it is until the next meeting. And then if they change it, well, then it just does an instantaneous jump. And so that's why it's like a staircase. The blue line is the actual market rate. That's if you go to the federal funds market and look at the interest rate commercial banks are charging each other. That's what this blue line is. Okay, so you can see the blue line normally is centered around that red line, because that's just how the Fed works normally, right? That it adjusts reserves to keep the actual rate in line with its target. But that starts breaking down in September of 2008. So you can see in September, the blue line starts dropping below the red line and it just stays below it. And so that, so again, what that's showing there is the Fed was pumping reserves into the system, or the demand to borrow reserves went down, either way. But for whatever reason, the actual federal funds rate was falling significantly below the target rate. And so the Fed said, what can we do? We don't want to have to sell off assets from our balance sheet and suck reserves out of the system in order to push the blue line back up to the red line. We don't want to do that because then that's just going to be hurting the financial markets more while they're already in crisis. And they said, but we also don't want to lower the federal funds rate just yet. Eventually, they would bring it down. But right now, at this point, you can see the federal funds target rate was still 1%. So they said, okay, what if we now can start paying interest to commercial banks to keep their excess reserves parked with us? So if we do that, well, then we can put a floor under the actual federal funds rate, because no bank is going to lend to another bank at a lower rate than we ourselves will pay it, because they know that, you know, we're the safest thing in town. You keep your reserves parked with us, for sure you're going to get paid. If you lend your reserves to some other bank, they might not pay you back. And so by being able to pay interest on two banks for keeping the reserves parked at the Fed could effectively put a floor under that blue line and make it whatever it wanted. All right, so that was the original rationale. That's what I remember Fed officials saying at the time. Now, one little thing here is, if you look at interest on reserves and lending, you'll see that lending collapses right when this program went into effect. Now, I'm not saying that's the reason it collapsed, but it's just funny when people talk about how TARP and all these other extraordinary programs were there to loosen up the credit markets and to get banks lending again. Well, no, they weren't. I mean, or they didn't do that, or they didn't obviously do that, because you could see total commercial bank lending just started plummeting right after all this stuff went into effect. Okay, but now if you talk about interest on excess reserves, it has to do with this Fed so-called exit strategy. So the reason that issue of keeping a floor under the actual federal funds rate, that's gone away, because now the target itself is basically zero. So the Fed no longer worries about banks lending reserves to each other at a lower interest rate than the Fed wants, because the Fed wants them to do it at basically zero. So that's not an issue. Now, though, the reason they say we need to have this tool of being able to pay interest on excess reserves is they say when it comes time for us to start unwinding these things, what happens if inflation starts picking up, price inflation, and all these excess reserves start flowing out of the system and banks start lending again? One way we can stop that is if we just raise the interest rate that we pay to banks. Right? So interest rates start rising and banks are thinking about lending money out because they can lend it out at, you know, 4 or 5%. The Fed might say, no, we'll pay you 2%. And so then the banks will say, well, let's just keep it parked at the Fed and earn a safe 2% rather than lending it out at 4 or 5%, and it might get lost. And that's the idea. Okay, now let's talk about some of these extraordinary programs. With all this stuff, let me just say, I can't go through everything the Fed has done. We don't have enough time. But I did just add another link that Danny should have put up there. I don't know if it's gotten blasted out to the list yet, of a nice little summary that I came across just today when I was working on these slides that the Fed puts out. So for these things like the term auction facility and all these other acronyms, if you want to see this nice little table the Fed made showing you all the different attributes of it, go check that out. And also in the questions for the professor, if you have very particular things, I will try to go do the research and answer those for you. I'm just saying, for the purposes of this talk, I can just give you the broad brushstrokes of these things. All right, so the term auction facility ran from December 07 to March 2010. So here the Fed would auction reserves for fixed terms, either 28 or 84 days, to depository institutions. So depository institutions means financial institutions that take customer deposits. I think we're back. So what the Fed was auctioning off was reserves. All right, so that's what you were beginning. So for depending on what you're bidding, either for 28 or 84 days, the idea is the Fed, you would have whatever, $100 million in more reserves on deposit with the Fed for 28 days. And then, so at the end of the 28 days, you had to pay it back. Or at the end of the 84 days, you had to pay it back. And you had to pay it back with interest. And so that's, so what you were bidding on was the interest rate that you were willing to pay. So if you look at the last bullet point, so the initial December 17th auction, the Fed went into that thing willing to lend out up to $20 billion. And they had 93 different bidders. The bidding started at 4.17%, and then it ended at 4.65%. And the Fed did, in fact, auction off all $20 billion. All right, this middle bullet point, the Fed also at this time opened up swap lines with the European Central Bank and the Swiss National Bank. Initially, $20 billion for the ECB and six for the Swiss one, and then later on they would bump up those numbers, meaning that the swap line with the ECB was expanded, and the same thing with the Swiss bank. Very quickly, what does that mean? Well, the point was the Fed wanted to be able to auction off reserves, you know, dollar-denominated reserves with the Fed to foreign banks, not just U.S. banks. But legally, it couldn't do that. Wasn't in its jurisdiction. So what they did instead is they would say to the ECB, we will swap with you, like, so we'll give you up to $20 billion of dollars, you know, Federal Reserve credits, and you give us euros, and then you can auction off those reserves to the people, the banks that are in your jurisdiction. Okay, so that's the idea. So it was a way for the Fed to be able to get foreign banks involved. Okay, incidentally, we have a someone who's not particularly keen on this lecture, but I think he's logging in and out, so it's pointless for me to try to boot him because he wasn't there the last time I checked. Okay, term securities lending facility. This ran from March of 08 to February 2010. So here what happened is the Fed would lend up to $200 billion in treasury securities. So that's an important distinction, right? That here, what the Fed was doing, they weren't creating more reserves and then giving them into the accounts of the people that were participating. Instead, the Fed was taking treasuries that were held by the system open market account, the SOMA. Right? So remember, the Fed, when it does open market operations, it buys things like treasury securities. So the Fed's sitting on a bunch of treasury securities. So here what they did is they went up to the primary dealers and they said, we will be willing to lend you our treasuries so that you can have them on your books for up to, in 28-day loans. And then what was the collateral that they were able to use? They were able to pledge things like residential mortgage-backed securities and agency debt. And agency debt means bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, right? Because they're now agencies of the government. All right, so that's what that means. All right, so what's the point of this? Well, if you're an institution and you're in trouble and you're sitting on a bunch of garbage assets like residential mortgage-backed securities and agency debt, and you're in trouble, it certainly helps you if the Federal Reserve comes along and then says, hey, don't worry, we'll lend you whatever, $1 billion worth of treasuries if you pledge $1 billion worth of your bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the reason that helps them is because the market wouldn't have valued those things as adequate collateral, at least not at the full, face value, whereas the Fed would. All right, so that's the idea. So that's where the subsidy is coming into play here, is that the Fed is sort of propping these things up by giving them loans on the basis of collateral that private lenders would not have accepted it at par. Okay, another one is primary dealer credit facility. So that ran from March of 08 to February of 2010. So here the Fed lends to primary dealers at the prime credit rate and overnight loans, and the eligible collateral they called a broad range of investment securities. Okay, the real interesting ones are these Maiden Lane things. So here, what these are, they were the Federal Reserve Bank of New York created them. They were limited liability corporations. Okay, so this, the New York Fed created these companies, and the point of them was to handle rescues of troubled firms that the Fed was going to get involved with. Okay, so the first Maiden Lane was created in early 2008, because there, if you remember, that's when Bear Stearns went under. So what happened is, behind the scenes, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York says to J.P. Morgan, somebody's got to take over Bear Stearns. You know, they're bankrupt. Somebody's got to take them over. J.P. Morgan says, okay, we'll do it. But J.P. Morgan's looking at their books, and they don't like what they see. You know, there's a lot of garbage on their books. So the New York Fed says, okay, what if we create this Maiden Lane Corporation that is going to buy $30 billion of the worst stuff that Bear is holding, and then you get to take over the rest of it? How does that sound? And J.P. Morgan said, well, that sounds a lot better. So that's what happened. I mean, so you can read the bullet points and see the specifics. All right, but that's – so there, I mean, it's a little bit funny. And the details of this, my understanding is we didn't really know the full details of this until the last December's disclosure that the Federal Reserve had to give. Okay? So at the time, you know, it wasn't clear, at least I believe this is the case. If somebody knows otherwise, correct me. But my understanding is, at the time, we didn't know that the New York Fed bought $30 billion, well, technically $28.2 billion of the garbage assets that Bear Stearns had. All right, so it just officially, it was like, yeah, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was kind of involved there in brokering the deal, but it was basically a private sector takeover, that J.P. Morgan came in and assumed everything of Bear Stearns. But I think, you know, I believe it was not until later that we fully realized how much the New York Fed came in and made that happen and basically gave a gift to J.P. Morgan. Okay, as far as Maiden Lane 2 and 3, those had to do with the bailout or rescue or seizure, whatever term you want to use, of AIG. So remember, AIG was going down because of those credit default swaps primarily, and the Federal Reserve came in September of 2008, I think like the day after Lehman failed, and that the Fed didn't do anything and let Lehman go under. Then the Fed comes in and takes over AIG. And so part of what happened here is the Fed creates Maiden Lane 2, gives it $19.5 billion, and then Maiden Lane 2 buys mortgage-backed securities from AIG. All right, so that's one way to help AIG, is to have the Maiden Lane 2 corporation buy those things off of their books and presumably pay a higher price than they would have gotten had AIG just tried to sell it out to private buyers. Then Maiden Lane 3, the Fed creates and gives it $24.3 billion. So here, what it was doing, this is kind of complicated. Maiden Lane 3 goes to the counterparties of AIG, the people that AIG had sold credit default swaps to, and it buys the collateralized debt obligations from those counterparties. So that AIG, so in other words, buying up the things that AIG was insuring against, so now AIG doesn't have to worry about those credit default swaps. Okay, so both moves were designed to relieve the pressure on AIG, or at least that was the ostensible purpose. But that last bullet point there, if you just think about it, that's kind of tricky, because technically the Federal Reserve Bank of New York's creating money out of thin air so that Maiden Lane 3 can then go to not even AIG, but can go to AIG's counterparties like Goldman Sachs and people like that and buy their credit collateralized debt obligations, right? So buying their junk assets and getting them off their books. And again, the official rationale was, well, we got to help AIG, and AIG is sitting on insurance on those things, so why don't we just buy them away from you? But of course, if you were those counterparties, it helps to get rid of your junk assets to Maiden Lane 3. Okay, and then the last slide, you can't see it because I wanted to enlarge the picture, But this is, what I titled this was sterilization. So you may have heard that term. I just want to explain to you guys what that means. So this is a picture of the Fed's balance sheet from 07 to early 09. And you can start to see when all these different programs are kicking in and you get a sense of their various magnitudes. So what people were talking about sterilization is, look at the bottom, and what color is that? It's like dark beige, I guess. I'm not sure, tan, whatever you want to call that. But the bottom category of asset here, you can see throughout 2007, that was primarily what the Fed owned. And if you go look on the legend, you can see that's traditional security holdings. All right, so that's basically government bonds is what that area represents. So now, once we start in January of 08, and especially going into mid-2008, you can see that that actually decreases. You see how that dark beige area shrinks. And it actually shrinks pretty significantly. And then it only starts rising again in early 2009. All right, so that is what we mean by sterilization. So what's going on there is the Fed, when it starts doing these other programs, it didn't want total reserves to increase. Right? Because remember, here, this is partly why it was unconventional Fed operations, is the Fed was not just trying to inject reserves into the system to lower the federal funds rate. That's not what was going on here. Here, the Fed was doing very particular things, intervening in particular asset markets, trying to change the prices of particular classes of assets, as opposed to just lowering or raising interest rates. And so that's why when this stuff started happening, when these other colors started expanding, if you will, especially in mid-2008, the total line didn't budge much until the fall of 2008. So the point is, the first half of 2008, actually the first three quarters, the Fed had started doing all these other programs, you know, these various facilities that we just talked about. A lot of them were kicking in before things really got crazy in September of 2008. And so the Fed, what we say is the Fed was sterilizing all those other activities. Okay, so the Fed would be doing things like buying, you can look. So Maiden Lane, the Maiden Lane ones, you can see how they start. And the Fed would offset those. So what was going on is the Fed would start buying, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York would inject reserves in the Maiden Lane corporations. They would start buying stuff from AIG, or they would start buying stuff from AIG's counterparties, for example. And then at the same time, what would they do? So that in and of itself would tend to increase the reserves in the system. But they didn't want to increase the reserves in the system. So instead, they started selling off treasuries so that the Fed's total balance sheet didn't grow. It's just the composition of the Fed's balance sheet changed. And so that's what was happening up until the point when, of course, it just starts going through the roof. Okay, so anyway, that's what people meant by sterilization. You may remember people having talked about that, saying that, we don't even need to worry. This isn't going to be inflationary because the Fed is sterilizing these purchases. That's what it means. It means it's buying assets over here, but it's selling off other assets, in this case, treasuries, so the total amount of reserves isn't changing. And that's the idea. So you don't need to worry about price inflation. You just need to know that the Fed is manipulating particular markets. Okay, so we'll stop there. Like I said, there's obviously all sorts of things about what the Fed's done since this crisis has begun that we could talk about, but I'll stop the official lecture there, and then I'll check out your questions for this week. And again, if you have particular things, I will keep coming back and trying to answer those questions for you. Okay. All right, first of all, let me answer this one because a student emailed to me and I said I would post it and answer it in front of everybody. Okay, so Steve says, During the crisis beginning 18 to 24 months ago, many were critical of mark-to-market accounting. How does that tie in with the depressed assets the Fed has been buying? Is the Fed just circumventing that accounting? So I already talked a little bit about mark-to-market, and yeah, I think you're right, Steve. A lot of what the Fed was doing, I believe, was just to raise the market price of those assets. So you think about it, for example, the programs where they were lending to primary dealers and things like that, or especially they're just going to go out and buy assets. If you know the Fed is there waiting in the wings to buy some of these mortgage-backed securities, well, then that's going to raise their market price, right? Even people selling them to each other are going to charge a higher price knowing that some of them the Fed's going to be willing to buy. All right, so I think you're right that that was one aspect of it. Okay, and then Steve says, how likely is the Fed's action of buying depressed assets politically motivated to shore up falling tax revenue of local and state governments versus saving stressed banks or the housing industry? Okay, I think what Steve is saying is state and local governments, a lot of their revenue comes from property taxes, which is predicated on home values. And so if the real estate market collapses, well, then local governments get crushed because then when they reevaluate property values, they're much lower, and so they get less revenue. And so I think Steve is saying, is the Fed trying to prop up the real estate market to help state and local governments, or are they primarily trying to rescue the big banks and others that were sitting on mortgage-backed securities and so forth? I'm not sure, Steve, but my guess is they're just trying to rescue the big banks, because if they were just trying to help the real estate market, I mean, I've seen figures, and I don't know how accurate this is, but I've seen things showing that if the Fed had just announced from day one, we're going to create $1 trillion and just directly start buying mortgages from people who are defaulting. You know, so somebody got into a house they can't afford to stay in, and Ben Bernanke is going to come and buy your house from you at whatever you paid for it, and just let you get out of your mortgage that way, and you walk away, and the bank gets made whole because you paid off the mortgage. And so the Fed just starts accumulating all these houses that they would have been able to rescue the real estate market much more cheaply than the amount of money they've already spent, and presumably that would solve the problem. Okay, so like I said, I don't know if that's true, and you have to wonder about all sorts of strategic implications of the Fed starting to do that. But the point is, I don't think the primary goal has been to resuscitate the real estate market. I think the primary goal was to rescue particular investment banks that were sitting on assets that they were in trouble with, and the best way for them to do that was just to come in and buy those particular assets. I mean, one way of seeing it is, if their goal had been to pump up the real estate market, they're not doing a very good job. So, I mean, you could just say, well, that's because the Fed's incompetent, but let me put you this way. Think of the two things. One is, do you think maybe the Fed was trying to help the investment banks, or do you think the Fed was trying to pump up the real estate market? Well, the investment bankers and all those guys had record-setting profits right after the Fed did all this stuff, and the real estate market's still pretty awful. So I'm going with the fact that Bernanke was trying to rescue the bankers and not pump up the real estate market. Okay, we've only got about 10 more minutes, remember, guys, because we got to get out of here since Stephen Kinsella's class is right after this. Okay, Michael Perkins says, Krugman claims that most recessions are associated with falling prices and a deflation in the money supply. Assuming this is because the monetary base is so small relative to the money substitutes, could it be that having Paul Volcker versus Helicopter Ben is the real answer to the inflation versus deflation debate? Yeah, that's kind of a complex question. First of all, it's not obvious to me that most recessions post-World War II really are associated with falling prices. If you go and look at the CPI year-over-year change on like the standard Fred graph where it's got the recession bars, you'll see that the CPI goes, the rate of change spikes in a lot of recessions. It goes down in other ones, but in a lot of recessions it goes up. And so it's not obvious to me that Krugman is right, even in his basic claim that starts out with. And there's, you know, in terms of economic theory, you can think about why that would be the case. During a recession, real output goes down, right? So there, in a sense, there are fewer goods and services. And so if the same amount of money is chasing fewer goods and services, well, then you'd expect prices to go up. All right, so the reason Krugman is so sure that prices go down during a recession is because he thinks recessions are about demand. So in Krugman's mind, the reason we're in a recession is because people they're not spending enough. So duh, of course you're going to see prices go down. But on his blog, I've seen Krugman point at charts claiming, see, prices go down during recessions when half the recessions on his chart show prices going up into the recession. But in his mind, he just, you know, he sees what he thinks is going to be there. So I'm not sure. Now, it's true historically, back when we were on the gold standard, and certainly before the central bank, that, yeah, during a depression, you would see prices collapse. And you're exactly right, Michael. That was because the commercial banks would expand the money stock, and then they would chicken out, and then the quantity of money would shrink, and that's what would cause the bust. And so you would normally see a bad economy going hand in hand with falling prices. But now, with, you know, being on pure fiat money and having a central bank, that relationship's not so obvious. That for one thing, the quantity of money does not shrink during your typical recession. Okay, Aaron Liedemann says, could you please explain why when a federal government defaults on its loans, the currency implodes? I'm not sure. Okay, I think when you say a federal government, you mean like a central government? I don't know if you're referring to the U.S. federal government or you mean in general, if some country somewhere, if the central government defaults on its loans, what happens to the currency? Well, the problem is, conceptually, those are two different things. So if the government defaults on its loans, probably what that means then is people are going to see that coming, right? It's not, in other words, that the government's going to be totally fine, and then all of a sudden out of the blue it's going to default, right? People are going to see that the government's running big deficits, that its tax revenues are down, that it's spending too much, you know, that sort of thing. They're going to see that there's movements afoot to maybe default on the loans that they owe to foreigners. And so sensing that, people who hold bonds issued by that government are going to want to get rid of them. And so if you're trying to get rid of assets denominated in one currency and you're, you know, just trying to sell that and just switch to assets in some other currency, well, then that makes that currency fall. All right, it's looked at another way. If all of a sudden, suppose everybody in the world really wanted to buy U.S. assets, like they wanted to buy treasuries, that would make the dollar strengthen. And that's, in fact, actually what did happen. That in the fall of 2008, the dollar was strengthening because people around the world were trying to hold treasuries. Because how do you buy a treasury? Well, they're sold in dollars. So first, you have to take your local currency, turn it into dollars, and then go buy treasuries with it. And so when everyone wants to get your government's debt, that tends to make your currency strengthen. So going the other way, if all of a sudden now everyone says, oh my gosh, we don't want to be holding these things, and they try to get rid of it, that's also going to push down the currency in which that debt instrument is denominated. Okay. Okay, why don't we end with this question? Pratik Talol, sorry if I'm killing your name, says, presently, the commercial banks have a huge pile of excess reserves sitting on the Fed's balance sheet. Is there a possibility that these reserves might start leaking out? Why, when, and how rapidly when they do so? How will it affect price inflation? Regards, Pretik. Okay. So, yeah, that's a huge issue that a lot of people are talking about. So you saw in the slides I went through there, right now the excess reserves are roughly $1 trillion. So how are they going to start leaking out? Well, it's kind of complicated. Now, with Caitlin Long, I was explaining this, I think it was in the previous week's, in the Q&A there. The way you would see the actual line of excess reserves go down is, as long as total reserves are the same, is that banks, commercial banks, would have to start making new loans to their customers, right? So they would have to increase their demand deposits so that when you calculate and say, okay, given what their demand deposits are, how much do they need to have set aside in reserves to make that number go up? Well, then the total demand deposits have to go up. And then once required reserves goes up, then excess reserves shrinks. But suppose instead of that, suppose the commercial banks want to start using their excess reserves, but they don't do it by lending to their customers. Suppose instead they say, let's just start buying treasuries. Okay, so let's just say interest rates start rising. And so a 3-month treasury yields 5% and the Fed is still only paying 0.25%. Well, commercial banks aren't going to sit there earning 0.25 when they could earn 5% on a short-term loan to the government. So they would probably start buying treasuries. But that actually wouldn't cause the excess reserves to go down. It is measured, you know, the chart that I showed you. Because if you just think about it, a given commercial bank might write a $100 million check to the government, let's say, or buying a bond from somebody in the private sector, doesn't matter. Okay, so let's just say, make things simple, not that it would happen directly, but just to isolate what I'm talking about here. Commercial bank has a bunch of excess reserves. The Treasury says, hey, you want to buy a bond from us for $100 million? Commercial bank says, okay. So they write a check to the United States Treasury for $100 million, get a bond. The Treasury deposits that check. So now the Federal Reserve just transfers. It takes $100 million in reserves from the account of that one commercial bank and moves it over to the account of the Treasury. Now the Treasury goes up to an arms manufacturer and says, we want to buy $100 million worth of lasers. They say, okay. The Fed writes them a check for the Treasury writes them a check for $100 million. They sell lasers to the government. Now the arms manufacturer takes the $100 million check from Uncle Sam, deposits it in their commercial bank. So what does the Fed do? It takes $100 million from the Treasury's account, which is on deposit with the Fed, and transfers it over to the account of that commercial bank. So in the grand scheme of things, even though there's actual purchases going on, the commercial bank lent money to the government went out and bought stuff with it, so pushed up the price of lasers. Even though you got all this stuff going on, if you're just looking at the graph of excess reserves, that wouldn't move. Because at each step in the transaction, the same certain amount of reserves just keeps getting shuffled over to a different holder. Okay, so it's the only way you're going to see excess reserves go down in terms of the graph is if the way that the commercial banks let the reserves leak out is by making loans to their customers and increasing demand deposits. But if the commercial banks make loans to corporations or to the government by buying bonds, strictly speaking, that by itself isn't going to lower measured excess reserves, even though clearly you would say that's the excess reserves getting out of the banks and into the hands of someone in the private sector who's going to go buy something with it, but then they just find their way back into the bank again. All right. So anyway, my point is this is a complicated issue, and that in a sense that money could be leaking out and pushing up prices, even if you looked at the graph and it looked like it wasn't leaking out, because the only way you're going to see that number line go down is if the banks start making loans. Now, the good thing is, if it's just those one-off transactions, it's only going to push prices up for that one purchase. Whereas when the bank creates more demand deposits, then the total quantity of money increases. So that's partly why it's so dangerous if the banks make more loans to their customers, Okay, well, we got to stop here. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And remember to add Dave S. to your Christmas list. And we'll see you all next time.